the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, some quite fierce opposition in rural sectors and the farming sector in regards to the gun buybacks scheme, especially from One Nation.
Well, I don't think it should be a buyback. You know, these are law-abiding Australians that want their guns. So I don't see that it's not the buyback that needs to happen. It's the people who actually, you know, in the first place. These were people who were on the watch list that had the gun, committed the crime, not law-abiding Australians.
And we also hear about Treasury Wine Estates. Woes in the wine industry continue. They've reported a $1 billion loss in its full financial year results. That's all coming up. But first to the gun buyback issue. A national gun buyback scheme has been announced in New South Wales. It's expected to cost hundreds of millions of dollars. The Prime Minister and the Premier heralded the joint New South Wales federal government scheme as taking guns off our streets. The scheme would see 274,000 guns taken out of circulation, with those with excess firearms receiving up to $1,000 for their weapons from November the 2nd. By early next year, that figure would rise to $10,000 for those with guns that have a market value of more than $3,000. But farm groups and One Nation and Shooters, Farmers and Fishers have trashed the plan as woefully inadequate, and they say it punishes the innocent victims of who are legitimately needing those firearms for their work on farms. New South Wales Farmers President Rebecca Reardon says rural Australians think the buyback has a number of problems.
We don't want to see guns running around with haters and terrorists. And that was the real problem at Bondi. And what happened there was tragic. And every farmer, he was absolutely gutted by what happened. But to take away guns from farmers, essentially, who need it just to do their business, it's a tool of the trade for farmers, a bit like you need nails, you need hammers. We need these things to actually be able to effectively protect our livestock, protect our property, to actually do pest control, which we're required to do under law. Also to ensure that pests do not run rampant over our environment, and to take what we need to do that job away from farmers is going to make it very difficult for us to be able to do what we need to do.
And Moree farmer Matthew Madden says that he's seen the damage that feral pigs, for example, do on his farm firsthand, and that's the sort of situation where guns are needed.
Look, it's an incredibly divisive issue. Some of our city friends may not understand the actual need for guns on farm. Many farmers don't actually have these guns for recreational use. It's just really as a tool of trade. Now, I know they'll argue why you need 10. The arguments will be, well, there are different tools for different jobs. I probably won't get over that limit, but there are probably people who will be. So I believe that we should be able to strike a balance there, and people who can prove that they're actually doing the right thing to ensure that they don't get in the wrong hands and demonstrate an actual need for these.
But you have a pig problem at your place and no doubt in other parts of New South Wales, so guns would be an important part of that. Not just a pig issue eating the cross, but a biosecurity one too, so there's sort of a double-headed sword.
Absolutely. I mean, it was a few years ago, we were trying to, you know, we were getting pigs eating our chickpeas, and then I did notice an orange pig running through my wheat. It took me a few minutes to understand why it was an orange pig. It was actually spreading rust through the paddocks. And I thought, okay, I'm spending money on trying to control this rust, and I've got feral animals spreading it, not just through our crops, but could potentially be spreading it to other crops. Biosecurity that probably overlooked.
And the best way to do that is to control is with guns?
So it's the best way, but it's whole management, part of a management plan. Shooting, poisoning, trapping, all part of what helps. You need an overall plan to ensure that we keep the numbers down to prevent just what we've got now, an absolute disaster.
And for other farmers, you know, there's foxes, there's wild dogs, we need to control them as well.
Deer in other places.
Deer,
Look, it's probably a part of a vital part of an overall strategy.
That's Matthew Madden, who's a Moree farmer, talking about the gun buyback scheme. Well, over 500 people attended a One Nation Gun Forum in Dubbo on Saturday, with party leader Pauline Hanson and MP Barnaby Joyce addressing the passionate crowd. The event was held just hours after the New South Wales government made the announcement about the gun buybacks. Reporter Lucy Thackray spoke with Pauline and also Barnaby.
Has the New South Wales government approach to guns gone too far?
Look, that's up to the gun owners, and we're getting pushback. You know, they're getting pushback because they do believe they have. I'm not right across the legislation in New South Wales, so I suggest you talk to Jeff Bacon or possibly Stuart Bonds with those questions.
And if there is going to be a buyback, what would you like that to look like?
Well, I don't think it should be a buyback. You know, these are law-abiding Australians that want their guns. So I don't see that it's not the buyback that needs to happen. It's the people who actually, you know, in the first place. These were people who were on the watch list that had the gun, committed the crime, not law-abiding Australians.
And what are your plans for consulting with farmers?
We're in consulting with farmers all the time. You can see it. We just do it online. We do it from social media. We do it through meetings like this. We're all the time on the road, you know, whether I'm in the Hunter Valley or I'm here in central New South Wales. Even, you know, as recently as last week, I was in Victoria. You know, our whole life is in consultation so that we can be the better representation of what these people obviously want, which is what they're not getting from socialism and socialist governments.
Why was it so important to do this in Dubbo today, and what do you think you saw from the participation?
It's important because look how many people are there. They want to be heard.
And what are the issues that you're hearing from people about? Well,
on this one, it's just the intrusion of the state into the right of the individual, the form this time of people's guns rights, and the intrusion in their right by intermittent power and the desecration of the landscape, the frustration that people have that they're just being towed along by socialist zeitgeist, which is completely at odds with their free will.
What are the issues with a potential buyback?
Well, the state government can't, none of them can get it together. And why are we buying back? Why are we buying back rifles of people who never committed a crime? You're going to start buying back golf clubs?
That's Barnaby Joyce talking there to Lucy Thackray at that rally. There were 500 people attending that One Nation gun rally in Dubbo on Saturday. Well, New South Wales signing on to that gun buyback scheme. It's had an angry reaction, as we've heard, from farmers and sporting shooters and also gun shops. The scheme will see 275,000 guns taken out of circulation. Doug Alcock is the Director of Coaching at the New South Wales Sporting Clay Association. He told Josh Becker that the sector has been treated with contempt.
It's not being based on actual firearm value, as you already alluded to. There's a flat rate of value that's being given, which doesn't remotely meet what a lot of these firearms are actually worth, or certainly what they were worth before the new laws came in. It's a pretty poor attempt, really, and pretty disingenuous. It shows contempt, really.
So if it was market value, would you approve of a buyback?
Well, at least it would meet the requirements of the Constitution, wouldn't it, which Section 51 protects, where there's compulsory acquisition, fair value should be given. But this isn't fair value. It's flat rate. It's a basic copy of the Western Australian buyback. But the difference is that this is being done in cooperation with the Commonwealth, and so it's clearly not giving fair value, which is what the Commonwealth should be giving according to the Constitution.
We heard from Shooters, Fishers and Farmers MLC saying that he'll be arranging for other people in his family to become members to maintain the number of guns. Do you think that would be a widespread thing that will be happening in the I guess sporting shooter community or those in rural areas?
It's already happening. What I'd say about that is that since January, the rate at which the Firearms Registry is approving permits to acquire has absolutely plummeted. We're now out, there are people out there, a lot of people out there that are now out to 150 days waiting for a permit to acquire to be approved and still waiting, which is, you know, just turned on its head from 12 months ago when the Firearms Registry was actually the highest performing and meeting its statutory requirements. Why is that? They have their systems in place. Last year they were able to process PTAs in, 8-10 days. Now we're out to 150. Are they under direction to withhold or what? I don't know. But we might all have plans that firearms that could stay in the family legally, that might happen if we were allowed to have our permits to acquire. But what happens if they don't grant them?
Mm.
They pretty much have complete control over what's happening at the moment. And so come November, if the PTAs are not granted, what does the person with more than 10 firearms or 4 firearms, depending on their situation, what do they do about it?
Mm.
Have to surrender it.
Doug Alcock is the Director of Coaching of the New South Wales Sporting Clays Association. Well, Nikki Burke's a gun shop owner in Dubbo. She told David Claughton she was at the One Nation meeting on gun laws on the weekend, and there are a lot of people who feel this issue is something that could change their votes at the next election.
My husband and I have been staunch National all the way. That's how we were brought up. I'm Asian descent. I remember what Pauline says about Asian immigrants. When she first came on the scene. But unfortunately, a lot of things she's saying at the moment resonates with people like myself who were born in this country but from migrant parents. My parents would never dream of doing anything that the migrants are doing now. All they wanted to do was come here and make a better life for themselves.
Well, Pauline says, look at the people we brought into the country, the radicals, look at the numbers that are on the watch list. Do you feel that too?
Yeah, I do. I really do. I'm still astounded that the man had a gun licence in the first place. I can't believe he actually got a gun licence in the first place.
He was on a watch list, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, his son was. And I'll tell you now, if you in your family have somebody who has mental health or an AVO or DVO, you can't have firearms stored at that house. How come he could?
And what about the detail of the buyback? Does that, because in what you were telling me earlier in the year was that people weren't buying guns because the buyback information wasn't clear yet. So does this help you?
No, not really, because now people are just angry because they're not obviously feel that they're getting what the firearms are worth. And then there are some people who feel their firearms, some of their firearms are priceless. It's part of their family history, handed down from grandfather to father to son and hopefully to grandson. It may only be worth a couple of hundred bucks actually on the market, but to them it's not. It's not replaceable.
And $1,000 for a gun, or maybe $850 for a double gauge shotgun, I'm hearing somewhere.
Yeah, double barrel shotgun. Yeah.
Will that cover the average cost of a revolver double gauge shotgun?
Definitely not. No. So, for example, one of the firearms that we sell, which is extremely popular, is the push button Templeton. I mean, we sell them for $1,900 new. So what do you tell somebody who bought one just before Bondi that they're only going to get $850 for it, if that? Because I don't know who's valuing all of these. That hasn't been revealed. It's not really fair. Same with the Templetons. That's Australian-made. Yep. I mean, they're $2,000.
They look pretty lethal, though, those guns. I went and had a look at a test of that, someone reviewing them, and they can shoot pretty fast and very accurately over distance.
Well, yes, but so can a bolt action if you know what you're doing. Bolt action is exactly the same. A lever action, exactly the same. It's more of an appearance of the Taipan because it has the particular stock and it is a pump action or a straight pull.
And what about your business? You were struggling with sales down at 80% at one point. What's it been like in the last 6 months?
So it's been extremely difficult. The firearms, I would say we're down 90% in firearm sales.
So if gun sales are down but everything else, some things are up, overall, how's your business tracking? How's your bottom line?
I think 70%. There are lots of rumours going around that certain gun shops in the state either ready to close down or they're putting off a lot of staff.
Yes, yeah, some views there about what's happening to gun shops. Now, we also heard from Ejelabra Merino Stud Director and Grazier John Cater, who told our reporter Lucy Thackray that the buybacks don't understand how farms function.
Well, I think we've all been waiting, basically, to see what happens. And, you know, something that's brought out on the weekend, a bit clandestine, and obviously it sounds like the government's not wanting to experience the backlash by announcing it on a weekend. Everyone's been a bit waiting to see if it actually exists, and why is New South Wales the only state to sign up for this?
So I suppose people, if they were concerned about the legislation and then just waiting for the next step, or potentially, I suppose, waiting for an election to see if there's a change of party, what does that announcement and the date of November 2, what does that mean?
Well, that's a very good question. Like, why that date? I'm not sure. After the Bondi event, you'd think, you know, any money should be put into stopping extremist behaviour and, you know, identifying the actual threat and focusing on criminals and not law-abiding citizens.
A lot of people do ask why farmers want more than 10 firearms. Why is that something that is important to a lot of people?
You know, some things are handed down and are family heirlooms. There's going to be certain rifles or firearms that have an historical value and they're kept for that reason. There's going to be others there that are fit for purpose. And when I say that, depending on calibre size and grain and whatever, depending on what sort of animal, whether it's a feral test like a pig or a rabbit, would be obviously a smaller rifle required. Part of the issue is that you want to have some options there, I suppose.
What is the function, I suppose, more broadly, of a firearm on a property? Why is it so important for landholders?
Oh, look, they're another tool in the toolbox for all your animal welfare needs. Like if something was to break a leg and needed to be put down, it's a quick and efficient way to do it, and also safe as well for the operator. We get told to make sure we're doing our part, which in general most people are, and then they sort of take a tool out of the toolbox that's there to help us, and going forward, all the tools in the toolbox, you know, should be available. And even, I think, you know, we passed a motion at New South Wales Farmers to ask for silencers to be reintroduced, partly for work health and safety with damaging ears, and also so that you don't just scatter things to the wind with one shot.
The government argues that people are being compensated rather than simply having firearms taken away. Does that make a difference?
Well, I don't think it is. The way they've done it, I believe they're punishing and penalising people who actually follow the law and apply for store and use guns appropriately, whereas in this case, if the money, there's no evidence or data that's going to prove that the gun buyback will stop extremist behaviour in the first place. So really, they're only penalising the law-abiding citizens. The compensation, it's really like stealing. They're not actually, the compensation amounts at the moment don't justify the expense of the people who have gone out and bought guns, and that's before we even go into, you know, somebody who was to own a gun store and that was how they made a living.
If you don't believe these ownership caps are the answer, what changes would you support? What changes, given the scope of the event that happened at Bondi and the loss of life and the argument that, you know, New South Wales has more than 1.2 million registered firearms and argued that needs to be reduced? What change would you support?
I think the money could be better spent going back in towards programs to make sure the registrations are proper and that there's enough government funding there for those people to, for the bureaucracy, I suppose, to have it sorted. Whereas just taking back guns, firearms from people who are already law-abiding citizens is not going to help another Bondi event. Are the criminals going to hand their guns in, or are the terrorists going to hand their guns in because we've got a gun buyback on?
What are you expecting, I suppose, with that four-month difference between the introduction of the buyback and then an election?
Is there an end date to the buyback? Because the way I read it at the moment, I'd probably be, if I was to have something that had to go through the buyback system, I'd be looking to probably hang on to it until a possible change of government and a repeal. Because otherwise, how long after you are notified that you have a particular firearm or more than you should have or whatever it is? In the announcement yesterday, I can't find anywhere where it says that there is an end date to it.
That's John Cater, who's Ejelabra Merino Stud Director and Grazier, talking there about firearms and the buyback scheme and its impact on farmers with Lucy Thackray. It's 25 minutes past 12.
Every community has stories worth sharing. ABC Your Say is your chance to join the conversation. Tell us what's on your mind. Visit abc.net.au/yoursay.
Lots and lots of texts. This one saying, I'm a farmer and I think the gun buyback is a good idea because I believe 10 rifles is plenty. the argument about registered firearm owners is not the problem. It doesn't always apply. I believe that some of the shooters we've seen in recent times have actually been licensed, according to Ed, that one from Ed in Kempsey. And but there's quite a lot of texts out there that are quite anti the gun buyback scheme as well, coming from farmers as well. We'll get to them shortly. But change of pace now. Chris and Kate Mooreshead from Yenda, they've been named the 2026 Sunrise Growers of the Year. We heard about the detail of that on Friday, but their award comes at a time when water is becoming more expensive and harder to secure, with the third-generation farming family recognised for its work with aerobic rice production, a non-flooded system that's delivering strong yields while using less water. Chris Mooreshead told rural reporter Cara Jeffrey that the award is a humbling recognition of years of research and innovation, but growers are still facing challenges from water availability and rising costs.
I think that these days in irrigated agriculture, the standards are pretty high, yeah, for us to be recognised, for our entire family. Some of the things we're doing with R&D on farm and some of the results we've been getting with different rice production systems, it's an honour to have been recognised, as I said, amongst a cohort of very, very highly skilled and highly efficient businesses.
And the judges clearly saw something different in the way that you run your business. So what do you think you're doing differently from a more conventional rice growing operation?
I don't think we're doing a lot of things differently. We are trialling different production systems. We do use a lot of verbal rate technology, a lot of aerial imaging, and we do use a lot of tech and emerging technology to assist us in our plight. My agronomist James Mann and Deakin Uni professors John Hornbuckle and Wendy Quayle doing Wendy doing really important work on greenhouse gas emissions from different rice production systems. And John and James and I have been doing a lot of work on aerobic rice, non-ponded rice, and water savings, more efficient irrigation, and more tonnes per megalitre produced. So it's been really, really exciting stuff to be part of. Highly successful, far more successful than I thought it would be when I first commenced this project. So we've observed and experienced some incredible things.
And you averaged close to 11 tonnes a hectare across your rice program with your medium grain variety, Matilda, averaging nearly 13 tonnes. So if aerobic rice can deliver those results, should every rice grower be doing that? What are some barriers to people adopting the system more broadly?
Well, the barrier certainly for me over the last 4 years is going against every aspect of rice growing that I've been taught since I was very, very young. But we were pleasantly surprised for once, put it that way. So that's been the biggest thing, is the change in mindset for us to be able to undertake this kind of production.
How significant are the water savings, and does aerobic production fundamentally change the economics of growing rice when you're deciding where to use that increasingly valuable irrigation water?
Yeah, it absolutely does. So in terms of in return per meg terms, we've spent the last week crunching numbers on corn, cotton and rice. We get all sorts of varying numbers. When I crunch the numbers with traditionally combine sown and ponded rice and then crunch the numbers in an aerobic system, the aerobic system provides significantly better returns per meg. So water availability is improving slightly, so I suspect again this season, we did 160 hectares of aerobic rice production last year. I suspect we will probably aim to do something similar again this year, and we will produce in the same way. Anything we put in this year will be aerobic. Given the numbers are changing so much every day with rainfalls and supplementary events and increases in allocation and changes in prices for commodities, and input costs, the farming bit's the easy bit. It's the crunching the numbers and determining which way you're going to go. That's the hard bit.
And we've seen Sunrise announce cuts to its Riverina operations and workforce this week because of expectations of a smaller crop. So as a grower, how concerning is that, and what does it tell you about the pressure the Australian rice industry is under at the moment?
We don't like in any regard in regional Australia to lose good people. Sunrise has got good, well-trained staff in their milling operation, so we don't ever want to see that loss. Generally, when we lose them for good. I suspect that rice production maybe a little higher than even sort of 2 or 3 weeks ago was being considered. So it'll be interesting to see which way Sunrise goes. What I can say, though, is nothing gets more rice grown than a better price. I'm sure the Sunrise guys will be listening to that. The higher the number, the more tonnes you're going to get. So going forward, we'll do what we can, but we can only do so much in the face of water costs and cost of production.
Chris Moorhead there, who's the Yenda rice grower, Chris Moorhead, and Kate Moorhead from Yenda being named the 2026 Sunrise Growers of the Year. On the gun buyback, people saying, Don has texted in to say under the legislation you can still keep your family antique weapons, you just decommission them. Also someone's saying it's not the role of government to fit policies to suit gun shop owners to make a profit or to have people hand down their weapons to the next generation. And someone else saying, why are we giving airtime to One Nation on the ABC? And also someone's texted in saying, but buyback's actually a waste of taxpayers' dollars. Farmers and gun club owners and other sporting bodies don't shoot other people. There may be an issue with some unidentified persons, and criminals will always obtain weapons on the black market or make them using a 3D printer. So that one from JB. So quite a lot of text coming through about the gun buyback scheme. Someone saying Kelly Sloan's view about the buyback is pretty relevant as well, saying it will not stop criminals, is the text that's come through. It's 29 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Shortly we'll have some weather details. A little bit of rainfall on the coast at the moment, not too much, from showers here and there. We'll hear more about that later, but first let's get some news headlines. Adam Storey's there. Good afternoon.
Yeah, okay, well, I think we've done enough there on the gun buyback, so I'll just put that to the side.
Yeah, we've done a fair bit on that today.
Yeah, thanks, mate. Yeah. One Nation MP Barnaby Joyce says the party's still determining who exactly should be allowed to have early access to their superannuation. Over the weekend, the minor party proposed a rethink on super, suggesting it should be easier for Australians to access their retirement savings. The government, though, has hit out calls for that proposal. Jim Chalmers says there are already measures in place for those in hardship to tap into their super. The search for missing bushwalker Lily Hooper has entered its sixth day in the Natai National Park in the state's Southern Highlands. The 18-year-old hasn't been seen since setting out for a hike on Wednesday morning, with her car later found on a walking trail that evening. Police and emergency crews are continuing to search bushland today, with her family and friends also assisting. Another earthquake struck Indonesia's Flores region as rescuers continue to dig through the rubble caused by an earlier quake that killed more than 50 people. The new quake had a magnitude of 5.9 and hit at a depth of just under 10 kilometres. The US President Donald Trump is scaling back joint military exercises with South Korea, calling them a hostile signal to North Korea. Comes after the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un denounced this week's annual US-South Korean military exercise. The US President Donald Trump says he has a very good relationship with Kim Jong-un and isn't happy that the US agreed to the joint exercises a long time ago. That's about all I've got. Usual things happening today. The ICAC inquiry is continuing into the Liberal Party donations, and Alan Jones trial continues as well. So we'll have more on that throughout the afternoon.
And Cristiano Ronaldo announcing this will probably be his last year.
Yeah.
Playing soccer.
Yeah.
Mm, so there you go.
Will it be?
That's right. How much will they pay for him to stay in Saudi Arabia? That's right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for that, Adam.
Okay.
Adam will be back at 1 o'clock. Let's find out what's happening with the weather details of Freen Hussain's at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So we are seeing some showers or rain on the coast at the moment, but not much for the inland?
Yeah, that's right. So we've seen about 5 to 10 millimetres around the coast since 9 a.m. this morning, and we'll continue to see a bit of that over the next few days as we have a slow-moving high-pressure system near Tasmania that's directing some moist onshore flow. For inland areas, we do have a trough that is currently developing in the northwest parts of the state, so that's likely to bring some showers and storms to the far west today and tomorrow. And that will extend to the southern inland on Wednesday before spreading across much of the state on Thursday. So not looking at much rainfall with that, just a few showers and storms here and there.
So 3 to 5 millimetres, something like that, is that what we're expecting?
Yeah, mostly daily totals of 5 to 10 millimetres as that system moves through.
Right, okay. And but it is going to cover most of the state, is it?
Yeah, that's right. So the focus areas for today and tomorrow will be the far west, and then on Wednesday will spread across the southern inland, and then Thursday across much of the state.
Mm. But as you say, as it moves across, it's sort of cloudy, not much rainfall at all. It's just sort of, like only a few millimetres here and there, probably less than what we've seen on the coast lately, the last day or so.
Yeah, that's right. That high pressure system has been bringing some coastal showers over the last few days. But we'll continue to see that over the next few days as well. But that weakens off as that high moves across over the next few days as well.
And so once this this front moves through, what are we likely to see after that?
Yeah, so towards the end of this week and into the weekend, we might see some lingering shower activity, but might see just a millimetre or two, so not too much in terms of rainfall into early next week.
So once we get a bit of rainfall, a few showers, it'll be moving through and becoming dry after that.
Yeah, that's right.
Afreen, thanks for that.
No worries. Thanks, Michael.
It's coming up to 24 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, Treasury Wine Estates has reported a $1 billion loss in its full-year financial results. The loss came largely from a previously announced write-down in the value of Treasury's United States operations. The wine giant, which owns the brands such as Penfolds, Wynns and Wharf Blass, posted an overall 36% drop in year-on-year earnings for the 25-26 financial year. It's mirroring other concerns in the wine industry at the moment. Treasury is in the process of cutting 40 wine brands from its stable, reducing its global portfolio of 76 wine brands to less than 30. It's also restructuring its model, rebalancing its supply out of the United States by fallowing some vineyards in California. Here's some of what the Treasury's Managing Director and Chief Executive Officer, Sam Fisher, told the market about those results.
In F26, we took decisive action to ensure the health of our brands and channels. While this decisive action has impacted financial performance in the short term, I'm confident we'll emerge a more focused and financially strong company capable of sustained, attractive returns. F26 EBITS of $492 million was ahead of our guidance, driven by Penfold's performance in the fourth quarter. Importantly, the underlying performance of our key brands remains strong, led by China and our Asia markets. And in the US, depletions returned to growth nationally for the year, despite the impact of California distributor transition in the first half. We progressed our previously announced initiatives to ensure brand and channel health, including action to significantly reduce parallel imports into China. And processes to divest a number of non-priority brands and assets are underway, with a pleasing response to date. As announced in June, we are also undertaking a strategic and operational review of our US business. Importantly, we saw improved momentum for Penfolds and Treasury Americas in the second half. This is a result of the strength of our brand and encouraging trends in consumer demand.
Treasury Wine Estates Managing Director and CEO Sam Fisher speaking to investors after announcing that $1 billion loss in its full financial year results that came out last week. But then the share price actually rose after that announcement. It's coming up to 22 minutes to one on the Country Hour.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Australian Dairy Farmer Group has called on major supermarkets to provide genuine support to the industry as Woolworths scraps its farmers' own milk. The specialty brand is promoted to shoppers as giving farmers a better deal for their milk, but after 13 years on the shelves, it's being discontinued, as we heard last week. Australian Dairy Farmers President Ben Bennett says only a small portion of farmers were involved in that scheme, and it didn't significantly improve the industry as a whole.
I feel that Woolies were trying to appeal to the general Australian community that they had a more closer association with Australian dairy farmers. They had suppliers across the country, but in all fairness, it was very few. Okay, so I think it was really more of a very much a token exercise and them creating a perspective of how close that association is with farmers per se. And I think they were giving a significant bonus or premium, but I think with the competitive nature of where the industry's at, they've chosen commercially, economically, or maybe whatever other reason to discontinue. Their market dominance with Coles is just gigantic. And you've got to look at the broader picture of dairy, and it's really just a drop in the bucket. It's just really tokenism. Like the dairy cabinet's far bigger than just simply drinking milk. The importation of the product, be it butter or cheese, from overseas is pretty apparent, particularly in their respective home brands and stuff like that. So I think they were just doing a bit of a PR sort of situation as opposed to having any credible, significant financial improvement to the dairy industry of Australia.
What sort of thing do you think needs to happen then with the supermarkets to improve that situation then?
Over the last 20 years, dairy's very fragile and has been in decline, and the governments, be they state or federal, and particularly federal, you know, we're in a quite frankly, in a dire situation. It's getting worse. Like this EU free trade, I don't know how many people are aware, but last year we imported just short of $1 billion from Europe. When people think Europe's a net importer of agriculture food, well, on dairy, they certainly are not. And a third of their incomes are government subsidised. I can't see how it's fair, this EU free trade. And food and dairy are pretty essential to the population of a continent, and we can't get that right. Like, our cost structure here in Australia is just does not make us competitive with the world, and they just continue to endear us with more regulations and supposed free trade deals, which might, you know, help them buy European cars cheaper in Canberra, but I don't know, the rest of us are probably moving towards peasantry, aren't we?
Australian Dairy Farmers President Ben Bennett speaking there to Justine Longmore.
You're with Michael Condon for the New South Wales Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, a merino industry veteran has become the most successful exhibitor ever at the national titles by winning the Supreme Merino Ram title for the third time. Robert Harding from the Glendonald Stud in Western Victoria has also won the National Merino Pairs title 5 times. Angus Verley caught up with him about his commitment to showing and his most recent success.
Yeah, look, it's good, but, you know, I just think you just keep showing to see where you are, and I think it's great for the industry because it does set the standard, the show scene, and that's true of all animals, really. The show scene sets the standard.
Now, Robert, tell me about this ram. I've seen some pictures of him. He's an impressive-looking specimen.
Yeah, no, he's pretty big. You know, today, as farmers, everything we sell is sold by the kilogram, whether it's meat, wool, or grain. So the bigger you got them, the more profitable they can be. So, yeah, no, he's pretty big. Very, very correct for a big ram to be so correct. He's pretty good. He's fairly woolly, so he's big and woolly. With the sheep industry, with merinos, or if you don't keep working at them, the inclination is to get smaller and less wool. So you're fighting against that all the time. So at the top end, you've got to have some pretty big ones. And I think last time Johnny weighed the ram, I think he weighed about 185, which is pretty, it's big enough, I think, yeah.
And as long as you can get people to shear them, I suppose.
Well, Johnny can shear them. yeah. And, they're not all going to be that big. I find it over my time, all you've got to divide by 2. So if they weigh 160 kilos, you can nearly say, well, that ram would produce ewes that'll weigh 80 kilos.
And you mentioned Johnny there. That's Johnny Dallow, who is a co-owner with you now. I read a good quote from him, actually, saying that on the points that you're making, he says that we haven't chased the fad of making our sheep little and fluffy with no wool on them. So I guess that summarises your breeding focus.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's just a matter of economics, isn't it? And practical, yeah. And how big and woolly you make them, that's up to your own management and your environment you're in. You know, our Merino breed is such a genetically such a varied industry. There's, I think Charlie Massey said there was something like 20 different species of sheep used in Australian Merino, of which probably you look around today, there's probably about seven or eight of them, signs of seven or eight of them left. So, yeah, it gives us the opportunity to breed sheep that'll suit nearly every area you can think of. And that's, that depends on your environment and your management.
Now, I know you're not about the accolades, but this does now make you the most successful ever, I believe, at the national titles. You've got three Supreme Merino Ram titles and five National Pairs titles. I mean, that must be something that you feel pretty proud of.
Oh, yeah, and, it's pretty proud because Paddy McDonald had owned Glendonnell. He showed sheep for a long time, and I'm only pleased that, well, it's still going up there with the best of them, and that's the beauty of shows. You can take your better ones and compare them. It's I think, pretty good for the advancement of the breed.
That was Robert Harding from the he was the winner of the Supreme Merino Ram winner from Glendonald. Merinos at nil in Western Victoria. We're speaking there to Angus Verley. Now, with wool of 15.5 micron, an August Shawn Merino from Boorowa was crowned the New South Wales Ram of the Year at that National Ram Show. It was from the Merivale stud owner, Wal Merriman, said he's the best that they've bred and they have high hopes for the future.
Oh, we had a bit of luck. We've got the New South Wales Ram of the Year.
It's fantastic. And following on from Bendigo as well, how did you go nationally there?
Well, he was Grand Champion Ram at Bendigo, the same sheep, and he's come here and been the New South Wales champion.
What makes him so special?
He's an ultra-fine ram, doing 15.5 micron. His main thing is his size and bone for a ultra-fine sheep. He's a very big ram for his wool type.
Is he the best that you've had, or has this been kind of a culmination of many years of breeding and you've got, you know, consistently strong genetics there?
Well, it's a bit of both, but yes, he'd be the best ultra farm I've bred.
What do you think it is? What has it taken to get to this point?
His grandfather was a very large ram, and I used him. He had a few foals. I used him, and he's put the size into this ram.
What is it about him that you think set him apart from the competition?
Well, his wool's very good. It's white, highly crimped for the Italian trade, and he's got a lot of wool for that type. But his size, it's the main difference between a lot of superfine sheep.
What has the season been like for you, and what does it mean, you know, in a year that's been pretty mixed for a lot of people to come through with that type of recognition?
Well, our season's been very good. Last year's the worst winter I've ever put in, and this year it'll be one of the best. Well, I don't know how to manage the weather, but the rest of it's just management. We had to manage, you know, quite heavily last year, where this year it's just easy. Green grass and stock are doing well.
How many years have you been in the sheep industry and how have you seen it change?
In our business, it hasn't changed much. We still have to cut a lot of wool for our particular micron and wool type. You see it in some of the broader sheep where people are going for light-cutting meat-type sheep. But for me, I'd prefer to do that with a first-cross ewe, but everyone has different ideas. But that's the main change that's happened in the last 10 years. The wool's coming off some of these Western-type sheep more in favour of meat, but I'm not sure how the total package works out. To my mind, it doesn't. We have to keep wool on our sheep because we're keeping a ewe for 6 or 7 years, and if she's not cutting any wool, she's not much good to you.
That's Wal Merriman there from the Merivale stud and talking there to Lucy Thackray. It's 11 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Thank you.
Well, the Mount Isa Rodeo is one of the biggest events on the Outback calendar. It's more than just buckles and bull rides. It's where a love of the sport is passed on from one generation to the next. Behind the chutes, Kavina Kumar found herself with an unexpected reporting partner. Young cowboy Elias Werman introduced her to some of his rodeo heroes and wasn't afraid to ask the big questions about courage, community, and what it means to cowboy up.
Brendan Crawley from Yass, New South Wales. I'm a bareback rider. If you don't get nervous, then you really shouldn't be doing it. But we kind of, after riding for a while, you sort of turn that nerve into adrenaline and just go on with it. I try to think of it like a life or death situation, and the only way I'm going to win is if I stay on.
And what keeps you riding?
My family, definitely. I got one of my boys with me now. He travelled all the way up here with me. He's standing here with me now, helped me on my horse, and about to put a show on.
Hi, I'm Elias Werman, and I'm behind the chutes just to interview you from ABC News. What's your name and what do you do?
My name is Kylie Vonhoff, and I'm the 2026 Zonta Rodeo Charity Queen.
I heard that you raised the most amount of money for a donation. How'd you do it?
I did. I raised just over $134,000 for the SES, and it was just lots of hard work and a very big support system and support group.
Is there any other stuff that you love to do, like going on the ride? Because I spent all my money on them.
My kids spent all my money on them, so I've got no money left to go on them.
Any advice for a young cowboy coming up?
Stay in school and keep trying. I'm back to riding after over 10 years off, so I'm just excited to do it. I'm telling myself if I don't do it now, I won't ever do it. And I take a deep breath and I let the nerves just take me.
My name's Leanne Caven.
What are you doing here?
I'm roping tonight, and I won the round of the barrel racing today. My horse in the barrel race today, he was that fast, I had to really hang on.
That is awesome. Have you ever got injured doing this?
Not exactly at a rodeo, but at home on young horses, yes, but that's part of it.
What keeps you riding?
I just love the adrenaline rush we get when we go fast.
Any advice to cowboys my age?
Well, I just say have a go. Why not?
Good day. My name's Elias Werman, and I'm here to interview you. What are you doing here?
I just come to watch a bull riding.
Did you do any bull riding?
Anything? No, I did, but the bull riding's not, they haven't got that fast a bull, so I didn't worry about putting my name down.
Do you like riding in general?
No, I do like riding. I'd normally ride every weekend, but yeah, just whenever a weekend come up, I'll go there, mate, and just hook straight in.
Do you think if you had a chance, you would ride in one of the biggest competitions?
Oh, yeah. If I don't win it on the weekend, there's something wrong, so.
I love your hat.
Beauty. Thank you.
This young cowboy, Elias Werman, with his ABC mentor, Kavina Kumar, at the Mount Isa Rodeo. Did a pretty good job, didn't he? Let's go to markets. First up to Bendigo Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. Numbers increased to 11,600 lambs, boosted by 4,500 young sucker lambs off Banook and Baratta stations in the Riverina. These sucker lambs out of Merino used by White Suffolk and Poldors at Rams, sold at 250 to a top of 278 for the lead pens to process, and then at $215 to $246 to restockers. The overall average was $236 a lamb. The sucker lambs today were cheaper compared to the limited run last week. The best trade to heavy trade suckers from $280 to a top of $322 to be either side of $11 a kilo. Old lambs were mixed and there wasn't a lot of spark from the buying group. The trend erratic at similar to cheaper rates. Heavy exports $330 to $380 a head. Merino lambs to $340. After this, a lot of lambs $240 to $340 in a range of $10.50 to $11.50. Sheep was softer with a lot of weight coming in on old ewes, extra heavy ewes to $300, but most $230 to $285, a lot of mutton $7.20 to $8.20. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Corowa Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. Numbers lifted slightly to a total of 7,580 sheep and lambs, of which 935 were new season lambs. Quality continues to be mixed, resulting in big price spreads across weight categories. Two major export processors were absent from the usual buying group, and despite a lack of competition, the market finished fully firm. New season heavy trade lambs, 270 to 320 with a single isolated sale over 30 kilos, selling for $362. Shorn medium trade lambs sold from 253 to 270, heavy trade up to 26 kilos, $270 to $320, ranging from 1,050 to 1,200 cents per kilo carcass weight. Extra heavy old lambs, $368 up to $390. Mutton was unchanged. Extra heavy crossbred ewes sold to $300. Merinos with a 2-inch skin reached $295. Trade sheep sold between $180 and $230. I'm Caroline Ronald reporting remotely for MLA.
Let's go to Dubbo Sheep and Lambs.
The solid markets of last week found a few extra lambs with numbers lifting by 5,000 for a yarding of 22,500 lambs. There was a fair quality yarding with some good heavyweight lambs penned along with some good lots of tray weights. There were also good numbers of merino lambs in most runs along with plenty of exotics. Trade lambs were firm to $3 cheaper with the 20 to 24 kilogram lambs selling from 220 to 298 to average between 11.50 and 12.30 cents. Two pens of trade weight new season lambs sold for 270 and 296. Heavy lambs are 5 to 8 dearer with the 24 to 30 kilogram lambs selling from 302 to 343 to average 12.10 cents. Lambs over 30 kilograms sold from 326 to 380. Merino lambs are firm with the trade weight selling from 245 to 281 while heavyweight merinos sold to 295. Lambs for the restockers were 5 dearer with the crossbreds and exotics selling from 100 to 250. Merino lambs for the restockers sold to 274. Hoggets sold to 280. We have the balance of the lambs and 9,000 mutton still to be sold. This is David Monk reporting from Dubbo.
To Wagga Cattle.
Good afternoon. 4,035 mixed quality cattle sold to the usual export and domestic processors. There was extra feedlot orders in play this week, along with restockers operating after heavy rain across the supply area. The market produced mixed results. Lightweight steers lifted 36 cents, topping at 620 to average 1,447. The heifer portion gained 25, averaging 1,243. Feeder steers, lightweight, lifted 10 cents, 480 to 586. The medium weights were firm to 4 cents easier, 440 to 547. Trade steers and heifers sold between 440 and 545. Feeder heifers, lightweight, regained last week's losses, jumping 30 cents, while the medium weights were 8 cents cheaper, the bulk selling from 450 to 526. Heavy steers and bullocks were firm to 8 cents cheaper, 424 to 524. Heavy cows eased 6 cents, 384 to 428. Leaner cows under 520 kilo were firm, 330 to 380. Cows to the restockers topped at 476. I'm Leanne Dux for MLA.
To Forbes Cattle.
Numbers lifted this sale with agents yarding 1,145 head. Quality was mixed but fair, with yearlings making up the majority of the yarding. The usual buyers were present, competing in a firm to easier market. Yearling steers to feed were firm to 5 cents easier to sell from 470 to 570 cents for middle and heavy weights. Finished steers to processors sold from 465 to 474. The heifer portion was also 5 cents easier to receive from 444 to 520 cents a kilo. Better types to processors ranged in price from 470 to 525. Heavy steers and bullocks sold from 460 to 474. Grain heifers ranged in price from 430 to 445. Cows held firm, with heavy cows selling from 375 to 412. The best heavy bull reached 409. This has been Crystal Ridley at Forbes from LA.
And finally to Tamworth Cattle now.
1,195 cattle were scanned this week in Tamworth, 200 less than last week. It was a fair quality yarding with increased numbers of quality prime heavyweight cows on offer. Some usual orders were absent, however most buyers attended for steady competition. Prime yielding cattle to the trade made from 442 to 500 cents kilogram. Yearling steers to feed were limited and lacked quality to be 5 cents cheaper and ranged from 520 to 562 cents kilogram. Yearling heifers to feed made from 433 to 538 cents kilogram. Light steers to the restocker were considerably dearer. They made from 545 to 628 cents kilogram, while the heifers were 3 to 5 cents dearer and made from 450 to 528 cents. Prime grown cattle to the processor made from 370 to 460 cents kilogram. Two score cows to the processor were 10 cents cheaper to make from 302 to 359 cents kilogram. Three score cows increased in quality and in price to make from 340 to 385 cents kilogram, while the prime heavyweight cows were 3 to 5 cents dearer to make from 380 to 405 cents. The best of the heavy bulls got the 395 cents. This is Hamish Hosegood in Tamworth for MLA.
You've been listening to the New South Wales Country Hour, and a reminder, there's been more cases. I think it's 5 cases now of bird flu in New South Wales, one announced yesterday. And a reminder that the hotline number, if you see any sick or dying birds, give it a call, 1-800-675-888, 1-800-675-888. You've been listening to the Country Hour. We're heading up to news time.